Vote WNYC for coverage of the issues that matter. Support WNYC now by visiting WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by DataPipe Managed Hosting Services, providing application management, hosting, professional services, security services, and compliance solutions for mid-market and Fortune 1000 enterprises. DataPipe.com.
They tried to make me go to rehab. I said no, no, no. Yes, I've been black, but when I come back, no.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. By now, everyone knows artist Amy Winehouse did go to rehab, although she achieved fame by singing about refusing treatment for substance abuse. She was recently caught on camera smoking what appeared to be crack in the UK. The British singer-songwriter is now one of the biggest stars in music and got 5 Grammys last night. But the topic of her songs is nothing new. According to a new study, over 30% of the most popular tunes in 2005 mentioned substance abuse. We are joined now by the leader of the study, Brian Primack. He is assistant professor of medicine and pediatrics at the University of Pittsburgh. Ann Powers of the LA Times will be back with us momentarily as well. But Brian, booze and drugs in music. Gee, who knew? Were you? What was the surprise in your study?
Well, I think you're right in sort of tongue-in-cheek mentioning that there really wasn't a whole lot of surprise. This was more of an exercise in doing a really good lay of the land, a really good content analysis of what's out there, so that eventually we can study what is really more important, which is to find out if messages in popular music that deal with substance use actually change behavior in the people that listen to them. So this study did not say anything about that. This is really just a precursor, but the results in themselves were interesting enough to report.
So those results mentioned 2 genres especially, hip-hop, okay, and country music?
Yes. Now, interestingly enough, though, I have to correct a couple of things. First of all, it's very important to emphasize that it's not substance abuse that we looked at, but substance use. The reason that that's important is you can say in a song, oh, yes, there was someone drinking alcohol, but you can't necessarily say, was this abused? Because that would take specific psychiatric criteria. So, that, you know, that's one thing that I wanted to clarify. The second, which is very interesting, is before doing this study, I didn't understand why Billboard magazine separated rap and R&B hip-hop. And this is something actually that I think Ann Powers might be interested in commenting on, because I really thought of them as very similar, rap and, you know, hip-hop.
Sure.
Well, it turned out that the numbers were extremely different in our analysis. 77% of rap songs had some substance use, and only 20% of R&B hip-hop songs. And so now I think I understand a little bit more about why Billboard magazine considers these very different genres.
So rap, you found 77% of rap songs. You were taking these from the Billboard Top 100 charts in 2005.
That's right. We looked at the year-end charts, and we basically took all of our lead from Billboard, because they are the experts in exposure, which is what we were looking for. We wanted to code and listen to the songs that were the most that sort of had the most exposure.
So 77% of the rap songs had some mention, at least, of alcohol, of pot, of harder drug use. In what we might generically call pop music, and this to me was a very striking number, that number falls to 9%.
That's right.
How do you explain that? Well, is this something that sells? And if so, wouldn't pop music be sort of leading the way?
I think that it sells, but it sells in different markets, sells differently in different markets. I mean, the people who are listening to pop music may not always want to hear these messages, you know, over and over again, whereas it might be, you know, for the standard person who's listening to rap music, it's something that they've come to expect or desire, you know, in some way or another. So I think that they've just sort of you know, developed that way, but they have changed a lot. I mean, something that was striking to me, and you mentioned country music before, that was a second in our survey. 36% of country songs had some mention of substance use, and of course, it was usually alcohol. And that was almost triple the number for rock music, which was now 14%.
Wow.
You know, and I always thought that, you know, rock would be much higher. You know, you think of the 60s and Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds and 8 Miles High and, you know, just it sort of being really founding almost this, you know, this type of music. And yet it's very different these days.
Well, one of the things that you have in your study, I should mention, we're speaking with Brian Primack. He is the head of this study on the amount of references to substance use in lyrics of popular songs. In this study, you give not names or song titles, but quotes from the songs. And, you know, we were able to kind of pair some of them up with, again, some surprises. A quote that you list in your study. Back at it, this cat is the wit and the charm, taking you higher like a syringe hitting your arm.
And yeah, and that's an interesting, it's important.
That's
to
a pretty hardcore image.
Well, it is a hardcore image, but interestingly enough, we actually coded that as only a metaphorical reference. We did not call that actual substance use. For something to be explicit substance use for us, we had to actually, it had to be something like, you know, I am drinking a beer. It had to be, you know, I can see the crack in your nose. we wanted to be very, very conservative and not code. So that that particular message only got a figurative reference, and we didn't include that. So so the 33% of songs that contain substance use, that's explicit substance use, as opposed to the kind of figurative language that you just mentioned.
Well, the thing that surprised me and the rest of the Soundcheck staff was when we Googled those lyrics and found out they were from Will Smith, who has such a kind of family-friendly image. Very striking. Here's the song. It's called Switch.
Y'all forgetting when I was amateur spitting before the scripts were written. First one in, last one out the club. Bursting in, passing out in the club. Back at it, this cat is the wit and the charm. Taking you higher like a syringe hitting your arm. Bringing the fire, making you binge, ring the alarm. Let me see you clap and spin, baby, come on.
All right, now also in the study, as Brian has been telling us, large preponderance of country songs mentioning substance use, and it's getting pretty close to substance abuse in this song, All Jacked Up by Gretchen Wilson. All right, Gretchen Wilson and Will Smith, two songs from the worlds of rap and country that, you know, not surprisingly, do mention substance use, which is so common in much of pop music. Brian Primack is assistant professor of medicine and pediatrics at the University of Pittsburgh. Brian, I wanted to ask what got you interested as a professor of medicine and pediatrics in analyzing music in the first place, but it does say in the study that the teenage group, especially 15 to 18-year-olds, is the most exposed to this. Was that your kind of the reason, the rationale behind you getting involved in this?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the top causes of death and disease in the United States, they're habits. They're things like smoking, alcohol use, diet, and exercise patterns. And as we see people in our offices, these are the problems that we see them with. And over time, you start to say, you know, gosh, I wish I could prevent these things rather than just having to put Band-Aids on them and sending them back out there into the world. And but before actually going into medicine, I was a high school and junior high school teacher, and I had seen firsthand just how into their media young people are. And I started to kind of put these two ideas together and say, gosh, I wonder what kind of messages are there in this popular music. Then there started to become a big media frenzy over smoking in the movies. And I'm sure you've heard that there's new evidence that kids who see smoking in movies are substantially like more likely to smoke themselves, and it's actually even a more important risk factor than parental smoking in many studies, et cetera. And so I realized that no one had really looked carefully at the relationship between music exposure and behavior. And even though music is, it's audio and doesn't have the visual component, these days it's very easy to have the visual component right there on your video iPod. And in addition, the exposure is much higher. It's around 2.4 hours a day on average, and that's even...
For the average 15 to 18-year-old, yeah.
That's right.
Which, by the math in the study, equals 84 references per day to some kind of use of alcohol, tobacco, drugs, et cetera. Let me bring Ann Powers back in, the chief pop music critic for the L.A. Times. And hearing Brian talking about this study, there isn't a whole lot in the big picture to be surprised at, but is there anything within the findings themselves, the things that Brian's been talking about, that you find yourself somewhat taken aback by?
Well, first off, I'd like to say I think it's great that Brian, you did this study. I think it's always valuable when people from different disciplines or approaches look at popular music and try to figure out how it impacts audiences and also the artists themselves. I will say a couple comments that occurred to me right off the bat. One is the fact that hip-hop and country had the most references to illicit substances might be partly because of the nature of those genres. And you could think about it this way. Hip-hop and country are the most storytelling-oriented of pop music genres. Pop, like, kind of R&B, pop, Rihanna type, whatever, Beyonce, although there are stories in those songs, sometimes often the lyrics are more abstract, and it's a lot about the sound and the feeling. They're not telling a narrative, and I wonder if that's one of the reasons why you get specific references to substance abuse, because, frankly, you get specific references to everything more in those genres. You know what I mean?
Because they're a reflection.
That's a great suggestion. I think that's really interesting.
It's possible, And then my other point, though, that I think reinforces what you're saying, especially in hip-hop, I know that my colleague Chris Lee did a piece in the LA Times about how hip-hop artists are actually being sponsored by alcohol companies now. They're putting out their own brands of alcohol. And I know country music artists like Kenny Chesney, when I went to see him play, he was sponsored by a rum company, and that was honestly the drunkest audience I've ever been around in my life. So, what can I say?
Let me take a
deliberate money connection between these genres and certainly alcohol, if not illegal drugs. And that is troubling, I think. They are when these artists become salespersons rather than just storytellers, then that, I think, is very disturbing.
I think that is very possible. We actually looked at that, and we found that 18% of substance use messages were connected with a specific brand.
Right, Alize or whatever,
We did think was high. I mean, obviously, we don't know if those were sponsored or not, but since that number is relatively high, it is suspicious.
So that does sound like it's a bit of a change. But Brian, let me take you back over 40 years to what seems on the surface to be a very kind of simple, family-friendly pop song by a very famous band. And you tell me whether this would have made your case study had this song been released in 05.
When I touch you, I feel happy inside. It's such a feeling that my love...
Brian Primack, all the Beatles want to do is hold your hand, but it makes them high. Now, is that, does that qualify as a reference to substance abuse?
I think that probably would have ended up being determined by our coders to be one of those not an explicit reference use, but that would be one of those metaphoric, figurative. So it wouldn't have actually counted in our final analysis.
They're not talking about endorphins, natural high. Although Paul McCartney, we know that he's done a little ganja smoking in his day. So
now, what about? I mean, all this stuff in the lyrics. how much attention do people actually pay to the lyrics? I mean, how much do we know if people are getting all of the words of the internal verses as opposed to the big hook in the chorus?
Yeah, can I comment on that?
Yeah.
I think one important thing to note, and I'm sure, Brian, you factored this in, was lyrics in pop music songs tend to be emblematic or phrase-oriented, although, as I was saying, some songs are more storytelling-oriented, but it's really, to me, the impact would have to do with how much it's emphasized in the lyric rather than just sort of a side detail. If it's really stressed as the chorus or a hook, then I think that's what people really, you know, take home with them. Lyrics have a different function in songs than they would in, say, a poem or a story or something like that. And it's really about embedding those particular phrases in the mind. I think that's the biggest influence. Another influence, though, which I'm curious about the study, is actually seeing perhaps these artists, you know, drinking a beer, maybe in a video or in a promotional shot or reading about it. It goes beyond just the lyrics, I think, into the kind of personalities of the artists. And that, you know, that's troubling, too.
Well, Brian, that seems to get to the second stage. You referred to this study as really being a first step. Would the second step be to try and kind of figure out some of the things that Anne was just talking about, whether this kind of the music plus the image of the musician can affect kids' lifestyle?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that it's not just that the actual message is, and a lot of what we're looking at is just, you know, is there alcohol or is there not? But a lot of it is going to be what is the context of that message. And I think that's something that Anne was getting to also. You know, is it glorified? Is it emphasized? And are there other associations, you know, with that particular artist that sort of, you know, reinforce that? And I think we're going to see totally different risk for different types of messages. And that's what we want to figure out is which one should we be concerned about and which one should we not and not bother harping about.
All right. Now, I have a final question for both of you because we need to wrap up. But before we do, let me just ask our Soundcheck listeners to leave us a comment on the Soundcheck page of our website, WNYC.org. Tell us if you are troubled by the high presence of these references to drug and alcohol in popular music or if it's just something that's so, you know, old hat and expected that it just goes by without any impact. And the question I have for both of you is, if you do something about this, if you try and clean up pop music, get rid of the bad behavior, the bad messages, will anyone listen to it anymore? It's a facetious question, but I
no,
mean, there's...
But, well, I think there's something to be said here. I feel very strongly that popular music is the place where historically, especially Americans, have talked about things that are otherwise verboten. And that includes sexuality above all, also race, racial issues. But, you know, perhaps excessive use of substances is another element of that. And I think we need to talk about that somewhere in our culture. And honestly, it's not happening in the schools. It's, you know, maybe parents are not doing it as much as they should. So I think it sort of surfaces, you know, return of the repressed. And I personally don't believe you can really regulate that. It's just going to come out. And lyric writers are clever. They're going to find a way.
I agree with that. And related to that, I mean, I don't really think that even if we were to find an association between content and behavior, I don't really think that limiting exposure is the solution. People are going to find these messages wherever they go. And I think a more potentially powerful strategy is to give young people and really everybody the tools that they need to analyze and evaluate these messages for themselves.
Yeah,
now, this
I
process
totally
we call
agree.
Media literacy,
and
this seems to be a much, you know, to me at least, to be a much more empowering approach. And armed with this understanding, teenagers might be more empowered to make their own informed decisions. And it's not about censorship. It's about everyone, you know, making their own choice and you know, having the power to figure it out for themselves.
And let's not forget, you know, there was the straight edge movement in punk in the 80s, bands like Minor Threat, you know, where
right.
there was no alcohol, no drug use, et cetera.
And there's lots of Christians in rock now, you know, so from Daughtry on down, there's lots of Christians out there making clean music. So,
all right. We've been speaking with Brian Primack. He is assistant professor of medicine and pediatrics at the University of Pittsburgh and lead author of this recent study on the lyrical references to substance use and abuse in popular music. And Anne Powers, the chief pop music critic for the L.A. Times. Brian, Anne, thank you both for being with us on Soundcheck today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
face. I get no kick from champagne. Beer alcohol doesn't thrill me at all. So tell me, why should it be true?
The London-based duo The Kills joins us for a live performance in our studio next. And coming up tomorrow, there's a new soundtrack on the London Underground, classical music. A music critic gives us his take on the music that Londoners are hearing on their way to work. This is Soundcheck.
I took even one sniff that would bore me terrifically too.
Thanks for listening to WNYC On Demand. Please check out our other programs at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This free service is made possible by our listeners. Become a member of WNYC today.